So we're going to be talking today about decision-making and choice. And so I'd like to have you imagine with me that I have a magic basket of fruit. And in that magic basket are any, you can find any fruit that you would like. So let me find out what some of you would like. You'd like a pear. An apple. A peach. Watermelon. Kiwi. Raspberries. Pineapples. All right, strawberries. It's a wonderful magic basket, and it can have anything we want. And you can choose, but not Michael. I'm not sure we can trust Michael to make a good decision. So let's choose for him. What should we choose for him? Pomegranates. No, I'm sorry. Carolina is very wise, and she has decided that you should have pomegranates. Do you like pomegranates? No. Are you allergic to pomegranates? Okay, then you have to eat it. Okay. I don't know, Nikki, I'm not sure. What would you like to have for a fruit? Papaya. I'm sorry, you can't have a papaya. What do you think that Nikki should have for a fruit? Gooseberries. Okay, gooseberries. Have you ever had a gooseberry? Well, then we think it's high time you tried. You're stuck. Okay. You don't need to make a decision for yourself. We can make it for you. Okay. How many people would like gooseberries? Who has ever actually had a gooseberry? Okay, I have no idea what it even is. Okay. So if I had a magic basket of fruit and you could have anything you wanted, how many wouldn't take anything? You all like at least one fruit? Cool. I was going to do ice cream at first, but then I decided that parents might appreciate it if I advocated fruit instead of the ice cream. But if I had a magic basket of fruit and you got to pick a piece, or you got to have a piece, who would you like to make the decision for you about what piece of fruit you are going to have? So, most of us would like to be able to make the decisions that affect us for ourselves. It seems obvious. And yet, sometimes it is so difficult to agree. Sometimes I hear people bemoan the fact that we are still arguing about abortion after all this time. Personally, I suspect we will be arguing about abortion for a long time to come. I am distressed that after all this time, we are still arguing about birth control and women's rights. At this point, those seem like something about which we could agree and move on. But abortion, I think, is trickier. Abortion requires that we acknowledge that not everything in life is black and white, cut and dry, on or off. Our reading this morning acknowledges this reality and, frankly, is likely to provoke people across the spectrum on this issue. 2 decades ago, I read an article that has influenced my thinking in this area, so much so that when I went looking for it for reference, not only could I easily find it, which is more of a miracle than you realize, but I also discovered that I had multiple copies of it. The article was published 20 years ago. The United States Supreme Court had just upheld Pennsylvania's Abortion Control Act. The act, in part, required that a woman seeking an abortion listen to a doctor's speech about the procedure 24 hours before it could take place. In November of 1992, Harper's Magazine asked 14 writers across the spectrum for the words they would speak to a woman who was a day away from her abortion. Some of the writers offered harsh words of condemnation. Other writers offered words of support and reassurance. One writer delved into the complexities of the situation. It is the words of this last author that stayed with me. Rereading the piece 20 years later, I found that while I did not agree with everything, still much of it resonated with me. I'd like to share just a few excerpts from that piece by Frederick Turner, a professor of arts and humanity at the University of Texas at Dallas. Imagining himself as a doctor, Turner begins, "Before we talk, let's get something clear. I'm a doctor, and the facts I'll be mentioning are backed up by my expertise as a doctor. But the intent of the law under which we are going to be talking is basically moral, and I am no more an expert on morality than you are. That isn't to say that morality isn't important, or that you and I can't get it right. In fact, we may be better at it than the authorities." After reviewing some medical facts, Turner moves on. "Now for the difficult part. Suppose your baby were at term and in the birth canal. What you'd have there would be a human being with rights that need to be protected. Some premature babies can survive when they're 3 months early. If we kill the preemie, the law would call it murder. They'd be right, wouldn't they? But let's look at the other end of the spectrum. I'm scratching my hand, as you can see. I just removed and killed some hundreds of skin cells. Each of them has a full set of my chromosomes. In a few decades, we'll probably have the biotechnology to clone one of them, one of those skin cells, into a perfect baby twin of me. So, in a sense, I've just killed a potentially viable human life. And yet we both know that it was a completely trivial act. In the hours after conception, abortion is utterly trivial. 9 months later, it is as serious a crime as there is. And for all of our wistful talk about trimesters and viability, the process between beginning and end is completely smooth. There is no dramatic moment of metamorphosis from scrap of tissue to human being. Many classical cultures abandoned babies even after they were born. They drew the line between what's human and what's not in a different place. And they weren't bad people. So how do we draw the line? Right now, it's up to you. You are the best judge. You're the one on the ground, in the trenches, dealing with the situation. After reviewing the way that activists on both sides of the issue try to simplify it and considering some of the other decisions we make regularly in life, Turner writes, "It might be helpful if you think of abortion as a sacrifice. The later the abortion, the heavier and graver the reason had better be, and the more sacred the whole thing is. And maybe it's sacred because of its connection with sex and reproduction. All of nature seems to rise to a pitch of beauty and intensity and expense when it comes to reproduction. Think of the mating colors and mating dances of fish and birds and mammals. But just because reproduction is sacred, that doesn't mean it's not wasteful. The human male wastes millions of sperm, and the female wastes a valuable egg every month. Spontaneous miscarriages are wasteful, natural sacrifices. If you abort a fetus intentionally for a good reason, you are in accord with nature's own tradition of sacred sacrificial waste. But the way that I look at it, sacrifice demands respect. It had better be done in good cause or it will come back to haunt us. That's why we make a beautiful communal ritual out of sacrifice, even if it's a highly symbolic one. Think of a Buddhist burning candle or a Catholic priest breaking a bit of bread. And there's another implication to the idea of abortion as sacrifice. If it's done right and in good cause, it can be something much better than just making the best of a bad situation, a nasty episode to be forgotten as soon as possible. What traditional religious ritual tells us is that sacrifice can be enriching, creative, evoking powers and values that can contribute great gifts to human existence. Isn't it possible that abortion, in the right circumstances, for the right reasons and intentions, could be like that? Turner concludes, "Our society doesn't provide us much in the way of ritual to deal with this difficult moment that you have before you. But maybe you and I can take advantage of this blundering, well-intentioned law and make our little talk into the beginning of a proper rite of sacrifice. Maybe you and I can take on a bit more moral and spiritual weight through this work we are doing together." Here ends the reading. As I suspect may already be apparent, I'd like to start this morning by talking about sex. It has been said that Unitarian Universalists would rather talk about sex than many other topics. This point is often brought up at the time of our annual pledge drive. Many of us are more comfortable talking about sex than money. Now, I'm going to guess that there are a number of people present this morning who would much rather talk about sex than the upcoming election. I suspect that some of you would rather talk about almost anything other than the upcoming election. And so to you, I apologize, because we are going to talk about both sex and the election this morning. And we're going to do it because I believe that I am compelled to do so by my understanding of our Unitarian Universalist values. Let me be clear about several things from the onset. Your understanding of our shared Unitarian Universalist values may lead you to different conclusions. I respect that. In our tradition, we have freedom of the pulpit. This means that as your called minister, it is my right and my responsibility to speak from this pulpit as dictated by my conscience. In our tradition, we also have freedom of the pew. This means that you are free to disagree with me and say so. Clergy, according to the IRS regulations governing nonprofit organizations, cannot speak about or support specific candidates or political parties in their official capacity. They may, however, speak to issues. Related to this, I am a strong supporter of the separation of church and state, which means that I think that keeping the institutions of religion separate from the institutions of government is critical. However, I believe just as strongly that there is a role for the values of religion in the public debate of our society. I do not know of what use it would be to have values if we are not going to use them. So back to sex. I contend that it is a shared Unitarian Universalist value that sexuality is a natural and healthy part of human relationships. Quoting from a piece on the Unitarian Universalist theology of reproductive justice, sexuality provides people with opportunities to grow in intimacy with each other and the sacred, as well as opportunities for harm and exploitation. as a powerful force that contributes to love and justice, as well as to intense discord and pain, people are responsible for being stewards of this tremendous capacity. Human sexuality must be understood and celebrated in its complexity, diversity, and possibility. End quote. This is why we teach comprehensive sexuality education across the lifespan as part of our religious education or spiritual development program. We call our program OWL, standing for Our Whole Lives. It's a program that provides developmentally appropriate offerings starting in kindergarten and going up through adults. The longest and most comprehensive program is not surprisingly for our middle school age youth. That program is taking place this morning and in the Enrichment Center and will take up Sunday mornings for the better part of this year. The predecessor to OWL was called About Your Sexuality, AYS. It was created back in the 70s, and it was pretty radical and state of the art then. A few years ago, I asked an adult who had taken AYS as a young person what they thought of it. Well, she said, when it was over, I was pretty sure they had told us everything. Our current program was developed through collaboration between the Unitarian Universalist Association and the United Church of Christ. The description of the program from its website tells us, quote, Our Whole Lives helps participants make informed and responsible decisions about their sexual behavior and health. It equips participants with accurate, age-appropriate information in 6 subject areas: human development, relationships, personal skills, sexual behavior, sexual health, and society and culture. Grounded in a holistic view of sexuality, Our Whole Lives not only provides facts about anatomy and human development, but also helps participants clarify their values, build interpersonal skills, and understand the spiritual, emotional, and social aspects of sexuality. End quote. May I suggest that this approach to sexuality education differentiates us from some other religious traditions? May I suggest that the attitudes and assumptions underlying this approach, in particular that sexuality is a natural and healthy part of human relationships, differentiates us from some other religious traditions? People I love and respect serve as leaders in some of those other religious traditions. They are not afraid to use their voices and their positions to promote their values. As much as I love and respect them, I must respectfully disagree with their positions. I would go so far as to say that some of their positions are dangerous and harmful. I think it is harmful to condemn homosexuality and birth control. I think it is dangerous to treat women as second-class citizens who cannot be trusted to make important decisions about their own health care. And I am compelled to speak. The specific topic before us this morning is access to abortion. However, I want to place it in a larger context. That larger context is the realm of reproductive justice. As it turns out, reproductive justice is the congregational study action issue for the next 3 years in our wider Unitarian Universalist Association. Since some of you are probably not familiar with our study action process, let me take a minute to explain it. It's important because it's an important part of our democratic process, a democratic process we hold dear. First Unitarian Church of Orlando is a member congregation of the Unitarian Universalist Association, or UUA. The UUA is an association of congregation which is run democratically. One of the manifestations of that democracy is the annual gathering of delegates from the member congregations at General Assembly, or GA. At General Assembly, the delegates do a great deal of business on our behalf. Among the things they do is pick issues for congregations to study and act on, thus the name Study Action Issues. Every other year, every 2 years, delegates choose a topic, a new topic, for study and reflection. Those congregations that choose to study the topic, they engage in action, they reflect on those actions. They report back to the next General Assembly on their experiences. For each topic, this happens 3 times, and then, if possible, delegates adopt a statement of conscience, that is, a statement that summarizes the views of Unitarian Universalists on the subject at hand. In recent years, delegates have adopted statements of conscience on creating peace and on ethical eating. We are several years into a study action issue on immigration as a moral issue. And last June, delegates adopted a new congregational study action issue titled Reproductive Justice, Expanding Our Social Justice Call. Although Unitarian Universalists have a long history of advocacy around reproductive rights, the newly framed issue adds a dimension that I think is critically important. It asks us to consider how issues of power and systemic oppression constrain access to reproductive rights and health services. In the introduction to the study action issue, we read, quote, "Reproductive justice represents a broader analysis of racial, economic, cultural, and structural constraints on women's power. The right to have children, to not have children, to parent children in safe and healthy environments is a human right," end quote. For those who choose to engage this issue, there are opportunities to consider a vast array of interrelated topics that expand beyond the traditional issues of sexuality education, contraception, abortion, and women's rights, as well as the issues of power and systemic oppression. Just as example, think of the number of questions that we could discuss in the area of adoption or childbirth options. I know that there are members of this congregation interested in exploring these areas together and considering how our Unitarian Universalist values might speak to these important issues of our day and to learning what we share in common and where our views might diverge. I look forward to seeing where this will take us. Wherever it takes us, I hope that we will hold on to our deeply cherished value of the right of conscience and the democratic process. In our coming together, we honor the search for truth and meaning, knowing that ultimately each one of us is accountable to our own conscience. There are some things about which we must agree, and there are some things on which we do not need to agree. It is important to know the difference. To the greatest degree possible, I believe that when there is an area on which we are unlikely to agree, we should frame our common life together to allow for as much liberty of individual conscience as possible. Let me say that again. In those areas where we are unlikely to agree, we should try to frame our common life together to allow for as much liberty of individual conscience as possible. This may be at the congregational level, it may be at the local, state, or federal government level. When it comes to abortion, a topic on which good people can draw different conclusions, I believe that we must create public policy that allows for individual choice. I know that there are people in this room who are strong advocates, not only of choice, but also of the choice of abortion in certain situations. I know that there are people in this room who strongly believe that they would neither choose an abortion nor counsel another person to choose one. I don't think this difference is a problem. We do not have to agree on that. What we do have to find agreement on is who will make that decision. Given the ambiguities and complexities inherent in the situation, I believe that this must be the person, the woman, who is on the ground in the trenches dealing with this situation. This is why, as we prepare to cast our votes for the upcoming election, I strongly urge a no vote on Florida Amendment 6. The proposed amendment to the Florida Constitution is titled Prohibition on Public Funding of Abortion, Construction of Abortion Rights. There are a number of problems with it. First, like all of the state-level amendments proposed, it should be a legislative matter rather than a constitutional matter, even if you think it's a good idea. Someday, I'm going to need to explore Florida's obsession with enshrining in the Constitution things for which other states actually write laws instead. For this reason alone, I plan to vote against all of the proposed amendments to Florida's Constitution. If someone can make a case for my supporting any of them, I would sincerely like to hear it. Another problem with Amendment 6 is that some parts are redundant and unnecessary. Even if you happen to agree with the intent, in particular, the proposed amendment provides that public funds may not be expended for any abortion. This is already the practice in Florida, so this component is unnecessary. More concerning is a related provision. Not only can public funds not be expended for abortions, but they may not be expended for, quote, health benefit coverage that includes coverage of abortion. This extension meddles in the right of public employees to choose the health care coverage that is right for them. It flies in the face of our understanding of the dignity of all people and in our faith in the ability of people to make the personal decisions that are right for them. It sets a chilling precedent. The proposed amendment does include an exemption when continuing the pregnancy would place the woman in danger of death. It does not, however, include an exemption when continuing the pregnancy would place the woman at risk of debilitating injury or illness. And the second half of the amendment is alarming. It reads, quote, the proposed amendment provides that the state constitution shall not be interpreted to create broader rights to an abortion than those contained in the United States Constitution. With respect to abortion, this proposed amendment overrules court decisions which conclude that the right of privacy under Article 1, Section 23 of the state constitution is broader in scope than that of the United States Constitution. End quote. In 1980, the citizens of Florida voted to amend the state constitution to say in part, every natural person has the right to be let alone and free from governmental intrusion into the person's private life. Known as the Privacy Clause, this provision is at risk from proposed Amendment 6, which attempts to nullify the right to privacy where abortion is concerned. Every day, women can and do make decisions about their reproductive lives with which I personally disagree. That would be a problem if the decisions were mine to make, but they aren't. We want the world to be simple, black or white, cut and dry, on or off, but it isn't. Which leads me to the last reason that I believe that our Unitarian Universalist principles and values call for a no vote on Florida Amendment 6, and that is compassion. From my vantage point as a minister, I have the privilege and sometimes the heartache of accompanying women and families as they navigate life's most difficult decisions. I have never seen the decision to make an abortion made lightly. That doesn't mean that it never has been, but I have never seen it. In fact, it is always heart-wrenching. The factors that influence such a decision are many and varied. None of us can pretend to understand all of the complexities that can arise. Compassion requires that as women struggle with these decisions, the state does not add complexities. Amendment 6 would enshrine dangerous complications in the Florida Constitution. Imagine a woman who has several children, is struggling to get by, and due to a failure of contraception, she faces an unwanted and unexpected pregnancy. She feels that her well-being and the best interest of her existing children would be diminished by the addition of another child to the family. She does not consider adoption an option. Have you known such a woman? I have. My heart ached for the choice she faced. Imagine a couple who wants a baby badly and learns well into the pregnancy that the fetus has a heart defect and will die before it reaches term. They can wait for the inevitable, or they can terminate the pregnancy. Have you known such a couple? I have. I would never presume to dictate what decision they should make. Imagine a couple who learns through genetic testing that any child that they have has a 25% chance of being born with a serious form of cystic fibrosis. If the child lives at all, its short life will be filled with suffering. Have you known such a couple? I have. While we waited for the test results, which would tell them whether or not the developing fetus was in fact in that 25%, I yearned to relieve them of the possibility of facing such a choice. You may not have known these particular women, but I assure you, you have known women who have faced scenarios such as these and many others. My experience tells me that more than a couple of women and men in the room today have struggled with these decisions. I do not believe we can reach consensus on right or wrong answers. I do believe that we can achieve consensus on compassion. The factors that influence the decision to terminate or continue a pregnancy are many and varied. None of us can pretend to know all the complexities that can arise. Given that reality, I believe that our commitment to the right of conscience compels us to advocate for public policy that creates the most spaciousness possible for honest, deep, and personal discernment. Compassion requires that as women struggle with these decisions, the state does not add to the complexities. Amendment 6 would enshrine dangerous complications in the Florida Constitution. I urge you to vote no on Amendment 6.